We're in chapter 4 in Job, and I think we'll get through 6 verses, maybe more. It's a fast read, but this is where we start to see his friends respond. So we've gone through the first 2 chapters telling us the story of Job and what happened to him. Then the chapter 3 where Job responds to what happened to him. And then the first series of speeches is now coming from his friends. His and I'm going to read it from the CSB, but his friends are now trying to speak with him. We are all either, we have all either been this friend, or we have these friends who try to tell us how things need to go and are going to go. And yet, they also, it's not really a welcome conversation sometimes. So, Job's passion, he had vented essentially to his friends the previous chapter. And now that the ice has been broken, the friends are like, okay, now we can talk. They were waiting on that moment. They sat silently for 7 days, waiting on Job to make the first move, so to speak. And maybe they had spoken with one another, but no one addressed Job. Nobody had taken the opportunity to speak with Job. And you know, maybe they observed him, maybe they took notes, maybe they talked to one another. We can really sit here and talk about that and come up with a hypothesis as to what was maybe going on, but they all agreed in the verdict, so to speak, that Job's affliction certainly proved him to be a hypocrite. They felt, and we'll get into this and you'll see what I'm talking about, but they felt that Job had to be a sinner, but a liar in some ways. I mean, that's the best way I can word that. They kind of had this idea that Job wasn't telling the truth about who Job was, because there's no possible way the man can be as holy as he says and be facing the things that are happening with him now. Job's affliction certainly proved him to be a hypocrite, according to his friends, but they didn't attack him, and they didn't do it until by the, you know, he kind of expresses his discontent for the conversation. You know, maybe they're sitting there and they're murmuring, they're saying, you know, he really must be a sinner if he's going through all this. He really must be a bad person. Why has he been trying to play himself off as all holier than thou? Then he opens his mouth and he speaks. And when he speaks, he gives them more or less fuel for the fire, to say the least. And so they thought he reflected on God himself, and then he confirmed them in the bad opinion that they had before, that they had conceived of him and his character, and now they set upon him with great fear. And the dispute kind of begins, and then as it begins and grows, just as any dispute does, it gets a little testy and fierce in some ways. I mean, we all know how that goes. You sit in silence with someone, it starts with one comment here, another comment there, and the next thing you know, everybody's upset with each other and tensions are sitting really high. We've had that happen in this room before, so we all kind of know what we're talking about with this. But the opponents are Job's 3 friends. And, you know, so Job responds. Elihu appears almost as a moderator. And then at length, God himself gives judgment upon the controversy when it's all said and done. So as we go through this, we're going to see some of that. But the question in dispute is whether Job was an honest man or not. In reality, I mean, it's really something simple as that, asking the question of whether Job was really an honest man. the same question that was in dispute between God and Satan in the first two chapters is now the question that we're going to see played out almost as a theme through the book of Job. Satan had yielded it and did not pretend that, you know, his cursing the day was a constructive cursing of God. Job cursing the day he was born, you know, Satan never even really won the argument that was happening. But he cannot deny that Job still holds fast to his integrity through what he said. Even the comments Job made were more about how if he'd have been removed, then it would have saved everyone else the headache and the heartache. But if Job were an honest man, he would not have been thus sorely and tediously afflicted. He would not have gone through what he faced. That was the way of the times. That was the way it was believed. That was the way they kind of talked about him. Had Job not gone through those things, they would have believed him. But then you get into this whole conversation, and so at this point, he's going through these hardships. The friends decide they need to urge him to repent. Repent of what? Really no good way to, I mean, there's not an answer there. They're trying to encourage him to repent, to confess that he is a hypocrite, to make a profession of that. And Job says no, that he will never, he says, that I will never do. I have offended God, but my heart, notwithstanding, has been upright with him. And he still holds fast to the comfort of his integrity. And that's something we need to recognize as we start this conversation. Eliphaz, who was likely the oldest of the friends. And the reason that I say that is because typically they honored that timeline. The oldest to the youngest would speak if that was what was going to take place. So the oldest, the eldest would have probably been the first to speak following Job. And he begins the conversation and starts the conversation toward Job. Now, I'm not going to really, you know, he compliments Job, he questions Job, and he lays a lot of things out in front of him. And reality speaking, Eliphaz speaks for two chapters. So chapters 4 and 5 are Eliphaz speaking. Chapter 6 and 7 are Job responding. Chapter 8 is Bildad speaking. Chapter 9 is Job responding. This is where we're going to find ourselves. Chapter 10 is also Job responding. Zophar speaks in 11, and 12, 13, and 14, Job responds. That's the first round of conversation. That takes us up to chapter 15. Chapter 15, we're back at this point. Eliphaz speaks again. Job responds in 16, 17. Bildad speaks in 18. Job responds. In 19, 20, Zophar speaks, and so on. I mean, I could go through and tell you all that, but what you have is chapter 4 is the start of this. Eliphaz speaks. Well, the third time is chapter 22. Eliphaz then again speaks again, and it goes on through. And at this point, you start to see people's responses getting shorter to Job, while Job's responses begin to get longer. Now, what does that typically mean for us? Well, we all kind of recognize that, and we all kind of relate to that, don't we? Because we get through that third section of them speaking, and then Job lays claim to innocence in chapter 30, or 29, 30, and beyond, and then that's where we get into God responding to Job's claims and the ultimate back and forth. But Job is really in a place, and he just has finished venting how he feels. Job says, I wish I could die, basically. He says that I rue the day that I was born. Then Eliphaz comes in, and as I said, he was likely the senior. He questions Job in a way, in verse 2, of whether he should even try to speak to him. Verses 3 and 4, he kind of compliments Job and acknowledges the faith, I guess is the way to word that. And then in verses 5 and 6, he kind of infers how he thinks Job has been, but he doesn't come right out and say it necessarily. And he kind of alludes to things. 7 through 11, and we'll get through those, but he then speaks of a vision. Verses 12 and following, he then aims to bring down Job's spirit. He then goes into chapter 5, where we see him continue the conversation. So I want to look at verses 1 through 6 right now. We might go farther. I'm going to read through 11, though, because that whole first part of the statement, I think, is his initial statement to Job. But it starts in verse 1. It says, then Eliphaz the Temanite replied, should anyone try to speak with you when you are exhausted? Yet who can keep from speaking? Indeed, you have instructed many and have strengthened weak hands. Your words have steadied the one who was stumbling and braced the knees that were buckling. But now that this has happened to you, you have become exhausted. It strikes you and you are dismayed. Isn't your piety, your confidence, and the integrity of your life your hope? Consider who has perished when he was innocent. Where have the honest been destroyed? In my experience, those who plow injustice and those who sow trouble reap the same. They perish at a single blast from God and come to an end by the breath of his nostrils. The lion may roar and the fierce lion growl, but the teeth of young lions are broken. The strong lion dies if it catches no prey, and the cubs of the lioness are scattered. Could you understand what's being said to you if this was said to you? If this is how your friend chose to start the conversation, at some point you're going to look at your friend and go, just say it. Just come out and tell me what you mean. You're speaking in code. Now, they may have understood a little more about what he's saying. He's using metaphorical language to speak to Job as to not hurt him. But Eliphaz, starting in verse 1, excuses the trouble that he is now about to give Job by the way he says this. Verse 2, he says, should anyone try to speak with you when you are exhausted? You ever feel that way? You look at somebody, you know they're worn out, you know they're not worth speaking to right now, and you're like, should I really try to talk to you while you're exhausted? Should I really try to talk to you while you're down out and completely distraught by what you're going through, or your lack of sleep, your lack of wisdom, so to speak?
ESV says impatient.
Right. Exhausted. Well, I mean, when you get tired, what happens?
You get impatient.
The New King James says, if one attempts a word with you, will you become weary? Will you become impatient? The King James actually says, if we essay a word with thee, offer a word of reproof or counsel, wilt thou be grieved and take ill? I don't understand why all these translations are different. I do understand that they all are the same in some ways, though. You're talking about a man who is hurting, going through a difficult time. And when somebody has lost a loved one, what's the first thing you do? You walk in and say, I don't know what to say. Why do you not know what to say? Because 9 times out of 10, you've walked in, you've sat down, you've looked at them, and you're like, would it do me any good to speak to you while you're exhausted? On the heels of this weary problem you're facing, on your impatience, you don't want to hear me right now. That's ultimately, if you wanted my opinion, would ask for it kind of statement that's being made here. I feel like it's almost Eliphaz going, I know you don't want to hear this, but I mean, how many times have we had that conversation with a friend? You look at them or they've looked at you and said, I know this might not be the time, but when they say that big but right there in the middle of that sentence, what's the first thing that typically goes through your mind? Oh, here we go. Yeah, I don't want to hear it. And honestly, I can imagine Job probably felt similar. He just sits there and goes about how he's in such a negative place.
Or is this even necessary?
Huh?
Or is this even
necessary? Is life even necessary? And the first words out of his friend's mouth is, probably shouldn't try to talk to you while you're tired, while you're exhausted, while you're weary, while you're impatient, while you're going through this. That's just someone's way of saying, I'm going to do it anyway. You don't believe me? Look at the next part of the verse. He says, should anyone try to speak to you when you are exhausted? But who can keep from talking? This is like I'm sitting down with somebody right here. I'm not kidding. It's like, I know you don't want to hear from me, but I can't really keep my mouth shut right now. I think that's important. Who can refrain from words? There's no reason to fear. There's no remedy. But who can stop from talking? That's ultimately kind of the conversation that's happening here. The modesty that he speaks of himself and his own attempt. Eliphaz is not taking the management of the cause alone, but he humbly joins his friends with him and says, and as we will commune with you. I think it's a half-hearted attempt to be a friend, to sit down and say, look, I know we don't have anything we can offer you. The words we will say are empty compared to the way you feel. There's nothing I can say to make you feel better. Should I even try to talk to you right now? But I can't keep quiet. I'm here for you. Kind of statement. We've all been there. If you need anything, let me know. Right? We've said those words. You say them all the time when somebody passes away, when somebody goes through a hard time. Well, if you need anything, let me know. Do you mean it? Probably. Do they feel like you mean it? Maybe. Some do, some don't. Do they really want to hear it right then? Probably not. Because in their mind, the one thing you could do to make them feel better, you couldn't. Because it's impossible. When somebody's died, the one thing that you want is the return. You can't have that. Somebody's saying, if I can do anything to help. The first word out of your mouth. I mean, and I've heard people say it. The question's asked, is there anything I can do to make it better? Bring mom back. Bring dad back. You know, and it puts you in a spot where, I mean, logically, you know. But you made the offer. And they're trying to tell you what they need, what they want. The one thing that would make them happy in that moment. And you almost let yourself down because now you're sitting there vulnerable, just as they are, thinking, I've just made this offer. And now I can't uphold it. Now I can't give what they want. The one thing they want, I am incapable of giving. So it's kind of where the friends are at. Look, we don't know what to say. You don't want to hear us anyway, but we can't refrain from talking. And now that you've broken the ice, now that you've spoken, it's our turn. We're going to communicate with you. That's ultimately what Eliphaz is saying here. We are going to commune with you. We're going to sit here. And they... You know, they sit down and they kind of have this conversation. And you know, in this case, it's difficult. In difficult times, it becomes us to pretend no further, but only to try what may be done or said. We can't sit and pretend that everything's going to be okay. We have to eventually break and break the silence and try to mend a fence, try to mend a heart, try to mend somebody's mind, try to speak, to open a door, to hopefully guide them through it. We all have felt that. We know what it feels like. You know, the one thing you want to do when somebody's going through a negative time is make them laugh, right? You want to bring joy to their life, even if just for a moment. Well, a lot of excellent conversations have gone under the title of essay, or, you know, they've gone under the title of more or less just an attempt. An essay is written from one perspective, right? It's not a dual conversation. You say what you say, and then the person looks at you like, okay, great. You know, they don't speak back. How many times have we done that? You say this big, long... The best example mentally that I can come up with on this is when you send somebody a text message that takes them 8 years to read, and all you get back is K. You know what I'm talking about. You give this big, long discourse. You just absolutely tell them everything they need to hear, and you're feeling pretty good about yourself, and you hit send. And the response back is K or okay. Even that one's infuriating on that long. Like one word. Sure. Fine. Because immediately then your mind's going, they didn't read it. They didn't care. They didn't want anything to do with it. Why am I even here? We've been there. And we feel like people are being short with us. And the reality is they're not. They're in a place of hurt, despair, destruction. They don't necessarily want to hear. The second thing here is that there's a tenderness in which the way that he, excuse me, there's a tenderness in the way that he kind of responds to Job. He kind of puts it out there in a way, if we tell you what we're thinking, will it grieve you? If we speak to you and tell you what we think might be going on, is this going to cause you problems? Are we going to be a headache? Are we going to be a bother? Or is it going to be an issue if we speak as your friends and tell you what we believe might be taking place? Hindsight's 20/20, right? Because at some point, you realize Job probably regrets saying, you know, allowing them to speak.
Sometimes when you walk into a situation like that, you feel like you're having to walk on eggshells around that person. And that is hard.
I mean, the question he's asking here is something similar to, you know, if I speak in my mind, are you going to, is it going to bother you? Is it going to upset you? Are you going to get ill? Will you lay it, or will you take it to heart and apply it and blame us for bringing it to light? Will you, are we going to be considered mean if we say what's really going on here? How many times, don't be mad if, but, how many have we, I mean, I've said it before. You know, don't take this the wrong way. Don't be angry. Don't be mad, but. Those are the kind of comments that are happening right here. It's kind of a soft way of trying to approach a situation thinking, I know what's going on. You probably know what's going on, but you don't want to admit it. But I've got to figure out a way to tell you because I'm your friend and I care. I only say this because I love you, right? Those type statements. When the reality is I say this because I love to see you hurt from what I'm about to say. I can't speak for Eliphaz. I know that there are people that are that way in the world today that love nothing more than to bring you down by pointing out your flaws. I don't think that's what kind of guy Eliphaz is. I think he genuinely cares about Job. Nobody's going to sit 7 days with somebody that doesn't care. Eventually, after a couple of days, they're going to break the silence and be like, all right, would you get over it already? Let's have a conversation. So these guys have enough care for Job that they literally sit there for 7 days. They put their life on hold. They go sit with Job, and they are there, and they help deal with the situation. The moment Job speaks, Eliphaz says, look, would it be okay if we spoke? Is it going to grieve you? Is it going to cause you a pain or a problem? Can I tell you the truth, so to speak? We have a desire to help. That is human nature. Every one of us has that mothering instinct, so to speak, that immediately wants to fix things the moment they go wrong, especially with the people we care about. You see something going wrong with somebody, you immediately want to fix it. Somebody's losing their house, you want to put them in a new one. Right? Somebody's not able to eat, you want to get them, you want to take them and get them food, or you want to get them to a place where they can get something and not just eat once, but eat multiple times. But we hope, and reality speaking, we should probably be sorry if somebody does take it the wrong way. But sometimes we get angry then too, and we're like, look, I was just trying to help. I do that all the time. You get defensive when somebody snaps back at you. You don't think about the situation they're going through. They pour their heart out to you. You pour out your best advice to them, and they look at you and they snap at you, and they're like, that is not helping the situation. And immediately, look, I was just trying to help. We don't apologize. We just get angry because they don't want to hear what we have to say. Put all of those in your mind as we go forward from here into the book of Job. But we should be afraid of grieving any, especially those that are already in grief. And I think that's where the issue lies, is that Eliphaz is not necessarily worried about upsetting Job, but he's worried about causing more grief to an already grieving man. Job is going through a struggle. Job's going through a hardship. Job's going through a trial. And here Eliphaz is trying not to cause him any more pain. And, you know, in Psalm 69, David kind of talks about this. And so I want to read that a little bit. But Psalm 69, 26, what we see here is this. David kind of alludes to this. It says, for they persecute the one you struck, and talk about the pain of those you wounded. If we go back to 25, make their fortification desolate, and may no one live in their tents. They persecute the one you struck, and talk about the pain of those you wounded. Charge them with a crime on top of crime. Do not let them share in your righteousness. This is David's response. They persecute the one you struck. I'm already paying for my sins, and yet here I am being condemned for them by others. How many of us have ever felt so guilty in the sin that we've committed and the struggle that we're facing that we quite literally got upset the moment anyone said anything? Because why are you coming at me when I'm already going through a hard time? Why did you choose now to talk to me about this? You know, when we're already grieving, and here you go, one of your friends comes up and just starts lacing into you about all the wrong you've done. You definitely will not want to hear that or hear correction at that point. And you get angry. That's where David was. David's like, look, they persecute me while I'm down. I mean, it's the epitome of the kick them while they're down conversation. And that's kind of what we're seeing here. But then God afflicts justly, but does not afflict willingly. God does not cause us to suffer because he wants to. He does it because he has to. He made a promise to us that he would be faithful if we are faithful. He made a covenant with man. So when God has to inflict judgment on man, it's not something God wants to do willingly. Now, let that sink in. He loves his creation. He loves us as his children. He does not want to hurt us, but he will. Why? Because he made us a promise that if we were to not live according to the plan he set before us, we would not receive the gifts that come with living according to that plan. If God promises us hell, if we are a sinner and we are living in sin, and then got heaven, what's the purpose of him promising anything? It makes him to be a liar, right? And so therefore, if that blessing comes, then what's the purpose of us living a life that's worthy? What's the purpose of him setting all the guidelines if he's just going to break them? And that's ultimately what we're seeing here. And then there's this assurance that of truth and pertinent conversation with this whole thing. Who can withhold himself from speaking is the statement he makes at the end of verse 2. Who can keep from speaking? Who can keep from opening their mouth and saying anything? I realize it's not the ideal time. I realize it's not going to make you happy. I realize you do not want to hear a thing that I have to say. But I have to say it. That's exactly what Eliphaz is saying. He's saying, I know you don't want to hear from me. Maybe it's one of those conversations that we've had with people before where you call somebody up and somebody you haven't talked to in a while, they're going through a hard time, and the first thing out of your mouth is, I know I'm not exactly the person you want to hear from. Right? We had those conversations before, just me. You call somebody up and the first thing out of your mouth is, I know you'd rather hear from anybody but me. Maybe you've had a fight with a sibling and you find out that a parent has passed away or a grandparent, and you've been tasked with calling that sibling to speak to them about what's taking place. Obviously, if you're in the middle of a fight, the first thing you're going to say is, I know I'm the last person you want to talk to right now, but I need to let you know. That's not a conversation that's going to make somebody happy either way anyway, right? But it's a conversation that at this time, Eliphaz feels, I really need to talk to you. I need to tell you what's come to mind. I think I can help, but it's not, you don't want to hear from me right now. And so it was really a situation here, maybe, you know, the spiritual welfare of Job. I don't know that this is a pious type statement that he's making, saying, let me preach to you, brother. I think it's more of a genuine, caring friend who's trying to speak to him. But he's really saying, in essence, if we really dig deep into the whole conversation, it's almost like he's saying, who can refrain from speaking when it's God's honor on the line? When I need to tell you what God's laid on my heart, when I need to tell you what I believe God is saying to you through this situation. In ministry, when people call you, and sometimes you call them and you know they're going through a difficult time, you know that maybe they just got home from the bar, or you go find them in a bar and you walk up to them and say, look, I know I'm the last person you want to talk to right now, but I really need to talk to you. I need to grab your attention, and it needs to happen now. We've all been there. We've all had those moments, or maybe we've been on the receiving end of that, where the last person that we really wanted to talk to was the one that had the advice we needed. Whatever case it might be, it's foolish. It's really foolish pity not to reprove your friends. If you feel the need to reprove someone and you can use the scripture to back it up, and you walk away from it because you feel like, well, they don't want to hear from me, I think it's evidence that this is, I mean, you're going to be as honest as you can with your friend, right? You're going to open yourself up and you're going to say, this is not what you want to hear right now, but I need you to know. This is not the situation that maybe you, it's that tough news situation where you realize they're not going to hear it somewhere else, and it might cause an anger. It might cause a rift. It might cause a situation. A marriage is a lot that way. So you went home to talk to your husband and you said, you walked in the door and there was a thing and you knew he was going to be mad about it, but you knew he needed to know it. And the only way that it could happen is you literally just look at him and say, this is not what you want to hear. And you speak it. Knowing that there will be something possibly happen as far as his anger, but you know that there's nothing you can do to stop it because it's going to come out and you're the best person for the news to come from. It's the same thing with family. The last thing anybody needs to do is hear something. So, I mean, that's the conversation. So this is a good friend who's sitting down and he's saying, look, I know this is not the time, the place. I haven't the energy, but we need to talk. I really fought this and it just popped in my head again. I'm like, okay, I'm going to say it. It's almost like the breakup speech between a boyfriend and a girlfriend kind of mentality I've got here. It's not because I don't believe that Eliphaz is saying, look, we can't be friends. But the seriousness of that conversation, because it's that kind of a blindsiding statement that's getting ready to be made, whereas Eliphaz is trying his best to warm him up to something that's not going to be pleasant and it's going to sting. You know, that I really like you, but we need to talk. Conversation. I know way too much. Or is it, here we go with the, you're one of those guys. Not one of those guys, whatever it was he said in the play. Anyway, I just was sitting there and I was like, I felt that.
Here we go
again. Yeah, I mean, I've been there 100 times. And, you know, it's not easy. None of these type conversations are easy. But it also kind of opens up this mindset. And I'm going to try to get through these 6 verses. Like I said, it's a lot to take in. And I know it feels like I'm beating a dead horse about this, but I really want to get it home that this is a difficult conversation Eliphaz is about to have with Job. He almost exhibits a twofold charge against Job in this. Number one, the particular conduct under the affliction, he charges him with weakness and faint-heartedness. Now remember, he's really nice about it. He's not accusatory. He's not saying, Job, you this and Job, you that, and this needs to happen and that needs to happen. But he's laying it out there in ways that I think can be understood, but it's kind of vague. So it's like, are you talking about me? Kind of. There's still that little wavering. Obviously, he's talking to Job. But here he kind of, there's too much ground for Job with what he's saying. And he takes notice of Job's service to others. How many times have we used somebody's past against them? He takes notice of what Job has done for others. And then he drops the bomb. Think about it. Indeed, you have instructed many and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have steadied the one who was stumbling and braced the knees that were buckling. I mean, that's a pretty heavy impact being made right there. And he's talking about the goodness of Job, right? I mean, here he's literally saying, Job, you've taught many. Not only your own servants and children, you've taught neighbors, you've taught friends, you have been a stronghold for them. You have talked with them, you've been there for them, and now when, and looking ahead, kind of the statements being made here, now when you have one thing happen, again, we know the story of what took place, and he's calling it one thing. When God takes one shot at you, is the statement he makes, you fall apart. I mean, okay. Thanks, Eliphaz. You've got your whole family to go back to if you want to. You got your whole life to go back to. I've had it all ripped out, right? That's exactly the mindset we're all going to take if we're Job at this moment, right? But he's saying to him, he's like, you encourage those who were teachers by office, you, and you had countenance on them. You paid for teaching those who were poor. You helped them. You instructed many. And though a great man, you didn't think that it was below you to do so. You had everything going for you, and yet you felt like you could still help others. Think about the impact Job's life must have had. It puts you in a mindset where these men looked up to Job. Eliphaz looked up to Job. And it's almost that disappointment that comes when you find out news that really devastates you about the one you were looking up to. The faith that you have in someone, the moment it's destroyed and the rug's ripped out from under you, is exactly how this wording, if you want to put an emotion to it, that's the emotion. That's the emotion with which Eliphaz is presenting it. This is a man who's broken for his friend, but more so because he's seeing a crack for the first time. He's seeing the armor is not really there. He's seeing something that's flawed that he didn't see before. I mean, really, if we go through this, the example that he's talking about of Job here, wouldn't it be nice if that was the way people were today? You have instructed many and have strengthened weak hands. Your words have steadied the one who was stumbling and braced the knees that were buckling. You've held people up. You've walked them through trials. You have been there for them. You strengthened their hands. You were their hands, in essence. And you instructed them. You showed them how to live. You showed them the way. And then gets to verse 5. But now that this has happened to you, you have become exhausted. Now that you're going through a hard time, there's nothing left for you. You're nothing. You've disappeared. You're not helping anyone. I've been there last week. And thank goodness we have people who stepped up in this church who were praying for me. But not only that, I mean, Joe. Joe was a blessing last week, calling and checking on me, going and checking on people he knew I was planning to visit, and then calling me and saying, you know, just rest. I mean, it's little things like that that really encourage you. But this would be like me going to Joe and saying these things because he's having a down day. You know? It would be like me going to Joe and sitting down with Joe for a week, and then Joe speaks and you can tell he's devastated and destroyed and distraught and everything's going wrong. And the first thing out of my mouth is, I'm going to speak, but you're not going to like it. And here goes, you have done so well to help others. But now that one thing has happened to you, you're devastated and you're useless. Pretty sure that's going over like a lead balloon, right? I know it would with me. I wouldn't take that well. Why? Because I feel guilty for it? No. Because the immediate response I would have is, what do you know about my one thing? What do you know about the one problem? We get defensive. It's the human nature in us. That's what we want to do. We get defensive. And here Job, albeit two chapters later, will get defensive. But here we see this situation where he's calling him out on the situation. And he's really laying all this down in front of him. And the expressions seem to be kind of this. Well, Isaiah 35, 3 and 4 kind of have this idea in it. We've got to strengthen the hands of others. We can do what we can to confirm their feeble knees, but it's those that are of a fearful heart, be strong. That's kind of how we are. We come in fear and we're like, look, we got to be strong for you because you've been strong for others mentality. And the expression seemed to almost be borrowed from Isaiah and Hebrews, well, not Hebrews, but from the prophets before. But we should be abounding in spiritual love. We should love one another in that way. A good word, well and wisely spoken, may do more good than perhaps we think. But what Eliphaz is mentioned, but why does he mention all this here? Why is he really digging into him? He might be praising him, saying, you know, It's hard for me to see it that way based on the rest of the conversation, but it could be that he's praising him. He could be saying, look, you've poured into others. You've done this, you've done this, you've done this, you've done this. It's time to give back to you. I mean, that's one scenario. It's possible. But remember that Paul praised the Corinthians before he really dug in. And he really tore them apart. 1 Corinthians 11, you kind of get that conversation. Two, he remembers how Job had comforted others, and maybe he might expect that Job would be comforted by that. Maybe he's expecting Job to comfort him. I don't know. If conviction was necessary in order to find comfort, though, I think you probably need to walk away, because one of the things that we find out in the New Testament, especially, Jesus says what about the Holy Spirit? The Comforter will reprove. The Comforter will give peace. The Comforter will call us. So it's not our job to call someone else on the carpet, so to speak. But I think he might be saying this also in pity, because he's upset. He's lamenting the fact that Job, the strong one, the one who's there for everybody else, now is broken and going through a hard time. And I'll show you in a second what I mean, but verses 5 and 6 really kind of lead to that, and I've got to get to those. But the fourth thing is, and honestly, I think this is what most people think and most scholars agree with, is that he mentions this as an aggravation of the present discontent that he has, really showing Job how smart he is, saying you're not fooling anybody. See what I'm saying? There's a few ways here that we can look at this, and the question is, are these real friends? Or are they friends who are looking for a flaw to bring down the house, so to speak? We have them both, and you never know who they are until that moment when they show themselves. But in that moment here, could it be, and this is honestly the agreement that a lot of people have, it could be that Eliphaz knows exactly what he's doing, knows exactly what he's saying, and knows exactly where it's going to go and how it's going to get there. He's saying it because he's trying his best to tear him down. He's aggravating him with the discontent. And he's mentioning it, really trying to overthrow him. You've taught others, why do you not teach yourself? Mentality. You've taught others, why do you not teach yourself? You've done all these things, why can't you get over it? It's the whole classic statement that I've had people make to me before. Well, you're a preacher, you know, right? You get that conversation, well, you know, you've studied it, you should know. Well, you're a this, insert next statement here. But it's that statement that really drags you onto the carpet and shows you who you are and what the expectations that are coming from the other side are. Eliphaz had an expectation of Job. This is an evidence in some ways, maybe what he's saying is, he might even be looking at him saying, heal yourself. Fix it. Or, just in today's time, what's the one statement that you're always told never to say to somebody who's battling depression? Anybody want to throw it out there?
They're in a better place.
Well, no, not death, depression. Just get over it. That doesn't sit well, does it? You're in a hard place.
No.
But you bring that up. Death is a good one too. They're in a better place. Right. But a better place for me right now would be next to me. I don't want to hear that. oh, but they're not suffering anymore. Great, but I am. You know, there's those statements that you can really look at. And yes, while they may be true, they're also not very welcome. But depression is the one thing that keeps coming to mind with this, because that's what Job's dealing with here. And it's quite literally this statement. Oh, just get over it. Ah, perk up. You know, buck up, buttercup. It's that mentality. And that's the hard part that people don't realize. He's in essence saying to him, you know, he's rebuking him. He's trying to rebuke this depressive spirit out of him by bringing up all the things he does, but also by tearing him down at the same time. And so he kind of tries to stir him with this low-spirited conversation in verse 5. Now that it has come upon thee, now that it is thy turn to be afflicted, and the bitter cup that goes around is put into thy hand, now that it touches thee, thou faintest and art troubled. Now that you've faced this situation, now that you have seen it happen, I think ultimately what's happening here is this is someone who had spite for Job, who looked at the whole situation and recognized something. This man has always told everyone how to get through a hard time. But now that he's going through a hard time, he can't even take his own advice and get out of it himself. So I'm going to tell him about that. Why is it good enough for others, but not good enough for you? Why is getting them out of a funk, all the advice that you've ever given, now you're not taking? Does that mean your advice is terrible? I mean, it's a legit question. It's legitimate. What is he saying here? When we go through difficult times, there's this favorable construction, this favorable conversation, all these different things. He makes light of Job's afflictions. And he, in essence, said, talking about it touching him, the very word that Satan had used himself in Job chapter 1:11 and Job 2:5, Eliphaz felt, but really that was only half, the touching part that we see. It smites me, it wounds me. But speaking of Job's affliction, he really makes a trifle with it. He really makes a joke of it. And he's saying, it touches thee and thou cannot bear the feeling. It touches you, it strikes you, and you're dismayed, is the CSB version. And he makes too much of Job's resentments in the conversation. Isn't your piety your confidence and the integrity of your life your hope? He's questioning him. This is why it's not really seeming like a very friendly person. But is the character before the affliction, when we think about this, he responds and says, isn't your fear your confidence, your hope the uprightness, or your hope your steadfastness, your integrity? The word integrity has been instrumental through all of this. And ultimately, he's asking, he's saying, isn't your integrity your hope? Isn't that what you base everything on? The fact that you are considered a man of integrity, a man of character, isn't that your hope, the hope that you have? And here you are saying, life's over. I wish I was dead. I wish I'd never been born. I wish all this had never happened. I wish that this, and this. I know some of the strongest people who have been broken by depression, by struggle, by hurt. But in some ways, it's a case of, I can't pronounce that. I wanted to try to. It's habeas confitentum rem. That's terrible Latin or Hebrew or Greek or whatever. What it adds up to is this: out of thy own mouth will I condemn thee. I'm using your words against you. The same thing that you have done now is being used against you, and I'm using it to condemn you. Satan is a master of deceit, a master of destruction. And that's kind of what he's doing here. But by the grace of God, Job was allowed to hold fast his integrity. He was a man of integrity. And you see God say that about him twice. Well, English Bibles, common English Bibles, the original and all the ancient versions, put thy hope before the uprightness of thy ways. The Geneva Bible, which came before the King James, did the same thing. And even the Assembly Annotation in Mr. Poole's say, it's a 1660 version, that says, is not thy fear thy confidence, and uprightness of thy ways thy hope. But when we get into where we're at now, is not thy religion thy hope? I mean, even more of today's time, we get into those conversations. Is not your religion your hope? Are not thy ways thy confidence? The things that you do, the life you live, the things you say, is that not where you find hope and peace and confidence today? And that's what it says here. Isn't your piety, your religion, isn't what you stand for your confidence? Isn't that the confidence you have? The fact that you are religious, you have this faith in God, is that not where you find your confidence? And he even goes a step farther. And the integrity of your life or your character, you are a man of integrity because of your hope. You have hope in the unseen, hope in the things that don't matter to others, hope in the future. And that's what keeps you going. And here you are broken and pushing it all aside. It's kind of the statements that made, or is being made here. Did you not think that that would be your protection, but thou art deceived? Or would it had not been so, if it had been sincere, would it have not been kept thee from the despair? I mean, that's kind of what we're looking at here. We're looking at this conversation where grace is what the problem is. Proverbs 24:10 says, if thou faint in the day of adversity, thy strength, thy grace is small. If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength, thy grace is small. If it bothers you to the point where you're so broken, you have no faith. Now, that being said, think about the friend and what has happened to Job. Am I calling Job's faith small? No. But have you ever lost everything in one day? And by everything, I mean quite literally everything. Or 2 days. He lost everything physically in one day. He lost his health the next. Think about that. He lost a family. He lost his material possessions. He lost his livelihood. He lost his legacy. And he lost his health. And here's a man who's sitting there for 7 days mourning all of that loss. And the first thing his friend says is, this is going to hurt. But now that you've faced an adverse day, you're going to sit here and whine about it? Ultimately, that's kind of what it seems like he's saying. A man's character is not to be taken. If I can teach anything out of those 6 verses, it's this. A man's character is not to be taken from one single incident. Just because of my reaction in one situation, that's not who I am. That's who I was in the moment, right? Just because Job was down and out because he lost everything, does that go back on everything that was said about him as a man of integrity by God? No. It means that he's faced adversity. It means that something happened. If I judge you by one false move that you make, even if it's true or not true, the last thing you would want me to do is judge you by one thing, right? By one word you say. Maybe you get mad at someone and you cuss them out, and I hear it. And that's all I ever remember about you the rest of your life. it's not going to go well, is it? Because you're not going to feel good. If that's all I ever remember, and I walk up, you know, I don't want to cross you. You know, I saw how you treated so-and-so. It's not going to go well. One bad thing happened in a marriage. Is the marriage over? Or is it something to be worked through? You know, I know many marriages. I know of at least 4 or 5 marriages that I can think of. And I'm not going to say anything name-wise. I know it's getting late. And if y'all judge me about how many times I go over the time limit of the church service, y'all would invite me. I mean, let's just be real. But you don't, because you keep letting me come back and I still do it. That's beside the point. What I'm saying is, if I know of at least 2 marriages that have ended, and probably 4 or 5 that have had trouble because of something that never happened. Or at least I've been, you know, I can't speculate. I wasn't there on one case for sure, but the other one I know, it didn't happen. All because of someone having a vendetta. They call the wife and they tell her something, and she holds it against her husband for the rest of his life. He didn't do it. He didn't, you know, it wasn't him. It wasn't the situation, somebody's assumption. And they were just trying to ruin that for the man. Now, a marriage is a give and take, yes. Was that right for the woman? Well, if the thing was true, absolutely. But to judge him based on that, knowing him her whole life, she's judged him based on one event that never took place, and yet here he is. He's struggling. He's going through a hardship, all because of that one thing, one statement. The rest of his life has to depend upon that one statement for where the rest of it can go with her now. And we all know situations like that. You hear something from someone about somebody and you immediately jump on a conclusion and you think, well, if this is true, I'm never talking to the person again. And we don't give them any chances at that point. Forgiveness goes a long way, especially in some circumstances where things maybe didn't happen. The thing that's happening here with Job is Eliphaz is judging Job based off of one day. He sat with him for a week. You know, and he's saying, look, one bad thing happens to you. One bad thing happens to you, and here you are. You're distraught. You can't handle it. You've been sitting here telling everybody else how to live their life, and then the one bad thing happens to you, and you are done. Some example you are is kind of how that's coming across. And that's where we're going to leave it. But like I said, the one thing that I can take from this tonight, and I hope you can take from this tonight, is that man's character should not be judged on one singular event, but on the life that he lives and the character that's developed over time. We don't become who we are overnight, and we certainly don't lose it overnight. And it's definitely something we can think about. Any questions?